This is the Sonia Poulton Show on today's News Talk. TNT.
Welcome back. In this hour, we get under the skin of our politicians and ask, are they all just a bunch of reckless chancers? And we meet the man who believes he may have unlocked the secret to happiness. I do hope so. And a reminder of our question of the day. What institutions do you still have faith in? Sorry, I forgot my microphone there. And here's our phone number. Do let us know.
Our lines are open. From the U.S. and Canada, call 1-888-201-6425. From the U.K., call 033-0024-1026. And from Australia and New Zealand, call 1-800-670-3100. Free speech is alive and well on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Just some comments for you. Claire on Instagram says, I agree with Charlie. My favourite and most trusted institution is the good old British pub. Indeed. And of course, the only other institution that I've seen mentioned in regards to our question of the day is the fire service. And why not indeed? Because fire is one of those things where I think they're incredibly brave. I think that fire personnel are heroes, frankly. They do the very thing that the rest of us wouldn't do. And that is our natural instinct on seeing a fire, of course, is to run away from it, but they have to run towards it because of their job. So to me, that is an institution that I absolutely still have faith in. Yeah. And even though they tried to demonize them and blame them for Grenfell Tower. Right. So let me see what is coming up. Right. Well, first of all, I ask, is this a sign of things to come? I live near the government's National Physical Laboratory. Now, this is a very interesting building where World War II codebreaker Alan Turing came from. It's an intriguing building with all manner of mysterious things going on there. Ostensibly, they say they are the UK's National Meteorology Institute. They say that they are developing and maintaining the National Primary Measurement Standards. What does that mean exactly? But those of us who live nearby frequently compare the building and the goings in and out of the laboratory to Stranger Things. If you're not familiar with it, it's a long series on Netflix, and it's about a door to another world and a very odd laboratory in the middle of the community. So the NPL is one of those government organisations that has been entirely captured by the LGBTQ lobby, including being a Stonewall champion, which is the diversity equivalent of being a good little suck up to the ideology, no matter how balmy it got. The NPL is so pro-gender lobby that rather than fly its own flag outside of the building, it has been flying the pride flag for months, if not actually over a year. Well, I walked past MPL over the last couple of days and the flag was gone. It replaced with an actual MPL flag. Check out this video. It was so quick, but basically, just to give you an idea of that, I didn't realise that video that I shot was so quick. But basically, the pride flag has gone. And I think this is very interesting. And this has clearly followed the CAS review of last week, because it was still there last week, right? And so these are the continuing repercussions of that groundbreaking CAS review. And the fact is, no matter how many Stonewall points you can earn, sooner or later, the vast capture of institutions to the LGBTQ lobby was going to be busted. Shame it took a report to do it and not just basic common sense, eh? I mean, this is very typical, isn't it, of our world, that they become these champions, these diversity champions, and as soon as there's a problem, then they back off. Well, they really should have used their own knowledge, the great knowledge that is accumulated in that building, historically so, rather than wait to be told. And on that note, let's find out the second lot of UK headlines from our Gemma Cooper.
Keeping the commitment.
I love you guys.
Unbelievable.
24/7.
Listen to you every day, have for years.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And welcome back, Gemma. Weather's looking lovely out there. I know I shouldn't discuss weather with a former weather girl because it will take us off in all manner of directions, but it is looking lovely here.
I like the term weather girl. At my age, I love that. Thank you very much, Sonia. Yes.
Or do you know what? I'd be pulled in by HR for saying that, wouldn't I? If I was at the B, don't you say that? This person is non-binary.
Sorry to burst your bubble on the fire service, though. I heard you talking about the fire service there. My local fire service is under investigation of a series of scandals involving its treatment of women. One former firefighter, she's won a tribunal. I don't think everything is as it seems sometimes in the fire service, just like the police service. I think that's all beginning to come out now. So it's a story that is quite big in this part of the world about Avon Fire and Rescue. You can look it all up online. There's sordid details are there, but I don't think there's many institutions now. I think the one I would trust is the one I'm sitting in front of right now, TNT. I definitely trust TNT, given that I've worked in the mainstream all my life and I'm now working for new media. Definitely. And I'm a big fan of the pub, the Great British Pub, especially really, really old ones, you know, that look as though they could be in a movie. There's something about that and the cross-section of people that you always get in a really old British pub. It kind of is a very indicative way of getting the mood of the nation, the Great British Pub. So yeah, I'll echo those comments that you've had this morning about the pub. Great place to be.
Can't beat a pub after a long dog walk, although I never ever do it. But one of our producers always says to me, you're going to go to the pub after the dog walk, aren't you? No. But also, our British pubs, they are very traditional. I mean, who can seriously beat a British pub in wintertime, roaring fire, great conversation? I mean, it's just wonderful, isn't it? And that's why we love it so much. And that's also why, as you talked recently, there's been such an outright attack on the British pub, right?
Absolutely. 30 a week being closed now because they just can't make ends meet. And interestingly enough, I went away for the weekend to a lovely part of the Southwest, and the amount of pubs there, really great country British pubs, which would be an open all week, they're now not opening their doors until Wednesday lunchtime, and they're shutting their doors after Sunday lunch, when traditionally they would have just stayed open 7 days a week, because they can't meet the overheads, the costs, the energy costs, the supply. It's the oil as well, the price of oil for cooking a pub lunch now. It's extortionate. They just can't do it. And that's the thin end of a very big wedge, I think. First of all, we'll see them opening Wednesday to Sunday, and then it'll be Thursday, maybe just Friday, then just Friday, and then gone. We need to support them. It's really important. The remaining few places where it's different people from all walks of life can congregate and talk. Look how they really clamped down on pubs during the scamdemic. That is definitely where they want this to go. Stay at home, staring at your screen, drinking your one drink on your own, not talking to anyone. That's how they want the human race to go. Don't let it happen in the UK. Don't let it happen.
I hear you. Power to the people. What's going on with the headlines, Gemma?
Well, obviously, the big headline is Rwanda. We talked about that at the top of the last hour. We've just seen it on Matt Boylan's headlines. You know, the bill has gone through. It will be made law, and the planes we expect, if we can believe the government, to take off June or July. Many migrants saying, we don't care about your Rwanda bill. We're just going to keep coming over on the small boats to try and stop us if you can. Interesting that. It doesn't seem to be a deterrent at all. Rishi Sunak is going to Poland today to meet his PM counterpart, Donald Tusk, and to pledge another $500 million to Ukraine on top of the $2.5 billion he's already pledged in this year alone, taking, I think, the total up to more than $5 billion so far. So when I saw this other story, I just had to juxtapose the two. You know, Rishi Sunak swanning off to Poland. Now he's got Rwanda through. He's going to give away another $500 million to Ukraine. And yet we've got the most miserable British roads now that we've ever had. We're a pothole lottery. The RAC is saying the shocking state of the UK roads, which would be a lot worse had it not been for a mild winter we've just had. Potholes and breakdowns of vehicles due to potholes now in this country is up 10% on this time last year. The RAC is saying it would have been far, far, far worse if we'd had a cold winter, because ice getting into the cracks is one of the contributory factors of potholes. But it's lack of maintenance, lack of repair, lack of money. Except, you know, there's $500 million going to Ukraine. So, you know, don't worry about the state of the UK roads. We're supposed to be a first world country, something akin more like a third world country now. The RAC saying our roads are in a shocking state and they don't see it getting any better, Sonia.
We just seem to come last all the time in terms of our government. But Gemma, which one of those stories would you like to look closer at for us?
I just do think that the potholes is an illustration. You know, you might say, oh, why would you bother bringing a story about cracked roads? Well, because it affects every single person in the UK. And the cost, of course, is passed to the consumer. I mean, potholes affect the car's suspension, the ball joints, all kinds of components of the car. If you go over these potholes, which the RAC, the Royal Automobile Association, says are getting bigger and far more dangerous, hence the 10% increase and 30,000 drivers now more affected by these things on our roads. And of course, they're not getting fixed. And what the RSC has come out and said this morning is that we've been saved by a mild winter. It said the mild weather has masked the true state of the roads in the UK. And this, you know, think how many people live in the UK, 68 million people live here. Why on earth are we not maintaining our infrastructures? And yet, Rishi Sunak thinks it's fine to get on a plane today, jet off to Poland and pledge more of our taxpayers' money to a war that many people have absolutely seen through over the last few years now and seen what's going on, how many vested interests are going on in Ukraine. So it's a kind of broken Britain story, which I don't like bringing because it focuses everybody's mind on the negativity, the fact that our politicians absolutely can't even be bothered to fix the nation's roads. They all swan around in very nice vehicles with very nice suspension costing tens and tens of thousands of pounds and very robust vehicles with their security details. And it's the rest of us that have to fix our own cars or claim our insurance, which is going up and up and up, just because there is absolutely no interest on the quality of our day-to-day life. So on the one hand, money goes abroad. On the other, where it should be going, making our country a good place to live. No. And the RAC say it shows no signs of happening. There's 16.3 billion to fix the pothole problem now in our country. The government's pledged 8.3, but that's come from the failed HS2 project that didn't quite reach its target in the north of England. It's not new money. It's money that was going to be supposed to spend on something else. So they've said, OK, we'll give you 8 billion to fix the roads. Let's see if it happens, shall we, Sonia?
Well, I think it is an important story because next to the weather, of course, the British are completely obsessed with potholes and with good reason for all of those reasons that you've just outlined, including the strain it actually takes on our vehicles, how dangerous it is. People fall in potholes, break legs, all manner of things. But we had Mr. Pothole on the show recently. I don't know if you remember, Gemma, and he was talking. This is a man who has nationally campaigned about our pothole problem. And one of the issues that he was facing was the fact that money that had been given to local councils for potholes was simply not being spent on potholes. So again, it's like, who can we trust to do the job that we are entrusting them with? And it is an issue because there are many issues attached to potholes. So I don't think it is petty. And I think it really touches on so much about what we've been talking about on this show today, Gemma. And that is, once again, the UK just seems to come last in when it comes to the considerations of our elected representatives, be that on a national or local level. What matters to us seems to be at the end of the queue. That's not an exaggeration, right?
No, it's not an exaggeration. And what I am being struck by actually is the amount of people that have, started traveling again after the scamdemic and the restrictions and have come back to Britain and said, you know, they've been on a nice long holiday. Some of them haven't had a holiday for one. They've come back and they said, you know what? It's only now I've been away, I realise how bad Britain is. And I'm hearing that more and more from people. One of my neighbours went to France. She hadn't been away for ages, an elderly lady. She came back and she said, everything runs amazingly in France. It's great. The roads are great. Public transport's great. And I'm hearing that echoed more and more and more. And when you think about, you know, other infrastructure elements of our country, the water companies, you know, with Thames Water threatened to with liquidation, administration. So just hiking the bills up and passing the cost on to the consumer, hiking the bills up by nearly 50%. That's what it wants to do because it's owned by foreign companies. There's no interest in the infrastructure of the UK because everything is privatised and everything is owned by foreign interests or shareholders who mainly don't live in the UK or couldn't give a stuff as long as they get their shareholder dividends. So that's where we are. But we are facing local elections and we are facing a general election. Whether that changes anything, well, you know, my cynicism is rampant. I don't think it will. But you know, there is that also that argument of us taking matters into our own hands. Some communities have done that. They've gone out and put rubber ducks in potholes because they're so deep. They're effectively ponds. People have planted rose bushes in potholes. They're that deep. You can put a plant in. You know, that's the very British thing to do, isn't it? With
very
dry humour. Very British.
Yes.
But it does draw attention to the problem. I mean, it takes a lot for British people to really stand up against the system. We saw it 4 years ago. We did. It touched something in the British public, you know, our libertarian attitude. Whether we can find that anger with, to, you know, just fix our infrastructure. That's it. We'd probably be happy with that. But, you know, I held out no hope for our politicians at all on this one.
Let me read you some of the comments, although this is, I think this is very funny. Spyro pointed out that you just said water company to go into liquidation, which is brilliant. Of course, that's a line in its own right. Absolutely, it is. Shorty 2 says, all part of the plan to stop us driving. We had council fill up broken roads along the front of us with loose stones, all gone now with rain and tyres. Someone will eventually end up in our pond. And Lord Melbury says, misappropriation of funds is endemic. Take, for example, how much council tax is misappropriated into council pensions, which is not a service. Indeed, it is not. Gemma, thank you so much for bringing us the headlines today, and we will be right back after this break.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. One reason people tune in to TNT Radio is often because they're loyal to a specific show or personality. Our personalities have been a part of people's daily routine, and people continue to tune in. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Internet.
A stream online.
TNTRadio.live. Today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
And a reminder of our question of the day. What institutions do you still have faith in? And Carl on Instagram says, absolutely none of them. Can I withdraw my taxpayer money now, please? I don't think that's how it works, Carl, although I think rather a lot of us would like it to. Now, if you think that money can buy you happiness, then I'm afraid to say you are wrong. Or at least that is what my next guest certainly thinks. He is Professor Bruce Hodd, Professor of Psychology at Bristol University, and author of a new book, The Science of Happiness, Seven Lessons for Living Well. Good morning to you, Bruce.
Good morning, Sonia.
Wonderful to have you with us.
By the way, I would just say, I don't say that money can't buy you happiness, okay? So I don't think I've ever said that. It just depends on how much you have to start with, I think.
Good point. Would you know what I always say about money? And that is the only thing that money can solve are money problems, though. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Spot on. I think the trouble is that when you become focused on acquiring more and more money, then it ceases to have its value, if you like. Once you've basically covered all the needs in life, the basic necessities, the bills, all those sorts of things, having additional money doesn't really make you that much happier. And in fact, it can make you actually worse, because if you're sacrificing all those really valuable things like time with the family or time itself, then I think you're squandering our most precious resource.
So we shouldn't automatically think, for example, that a lottery winner has won at life in every area, right?
Well, that's right. And there's studies to look at this. They've examined different types of lottery winners, some who have large, vast amounts, and those who have got smaller amounts. And the general finding is that, yes, they feel more comfortable about life, but it's not necessarily, that doesn't necessarily translate into feeling happier. I mean, it depends on how you define happiness, I suppose. If you think happiness is just being content, then maybe that's okay. But if you're talking about that emotional value that we gain from the small things in life, then money doesn't necessarily do that. And sometimes, actually, it brings a whole lot of misery with it.
I mean, happiness is one of those difficult things, really, isn't it? How do you define it as opposed to success? Are they like the same in some respects?
Yeah, they're related. And people often ask me, what do you mean by happiness? And for me, it's just feeling that a feeling of contentment about your situation that you're currently in and feeling positive about the future. So it's all about positive feelings and thoughts. That's how I define it. So it's not necessarily moments of elation and joy. That's part of it. But it's also that sense of contentment, satisfaction, a job well done, feeling that you're just okay with life. That's happiness.
So your course, The Science of Happiness, I've literally never heard a course of this name, by the way. You're not making this up, are you, Bruce?
Because no, this
it sounds
is true.
Fabulous.
Actually, There's actually a couple of courses named after that. The inspiration came from a course originally started by my student Laurie Santos in Yale. And when I heard about this course, I thought, oh, I must try this out. Because at Bristol, we were having a really terrible year in 2018. We'd had a spate of suicides. The students were miserable. And, you know, this was just a symptom of a growing tide in this generation, feeling anxious about everything. So I wanted to do something, not only to make them feel better, but they're just much easier to teach when the students are happier. So it was really self-interest in many ways. I was trying to make them happier so I could enjoy my teaching job.
But why not indeed, though? I mean, who wants to be faced with, like, you know, students who are uninspired, who are dealing with depression as one example? I think that it's a great thing. So what is the response to it and what does it entail?
Okay, so the response has been fantastic. And one thing I'll just point out, which does make this course unique, is that we award credit, university credit, for their degrees, and there's no examinations. There's no written grades or any sort of assessment in that form, because that would have been counterproductive, because one of the things which makes them so unhappy is how their performance is measuring up. So we wanted to develop a course which gives credit on the basis of engagement, which means that they have to turn up at least 80% of the time to every live lecture, the small group meetings, they have to journal, they have to write about the exercises that we give them each week. And so it really requires a big commitment on their part. And whilst they might think, oh, no exams, that's going to be a breeze, actually putting in the effort and the time to turn up every week is actually quite challenging. But nevertheless, we always get a 95% plus approval rating, and the students just love it. For some of them, it's transformative.
That is actually amazing. And the thing is, what you're obviously doing is you're employing tools that are excellent in our everyday life anyway. For example, journaling, that's a wonderful thing to do. You can get rid of a lot of, you know, clutter, can't you, just by sitting down at the end of the day or at any point in the day and just literally kind of writing freeform about what you're experiencing.
Well, absolutely, Sonia. You know, one of the things, the main lesson in the book, The Science of Happiness, is to learn to stop being so egocentric, because we live inside our heads. And if you're just living inside your head, you've got this internal critic. It's always pointing out all your problems. But when you write things down, that has two effects. First of all, it allows you to process it, okay? It allows you to think about it more logically. And then you can review it at a later date and realize, you know what? About 5 months ago, I was miserable, but I got over it. So it gives you evidence that life does get better. And just paying more attention to those things, rather trying to deal with it inside your head, is the right way to go about it.
But Bruce, we're hearing so much about anxiety these days. We're hearing that, you know, generations of our children are feeling depression and very, very low. We know there are issues with suicide, as an example. Are we living in a particularly anxious age, do you think?
I think we are. This is a contentious issue. Some people are just blaming social media fair and square, and I think it contributes, but I think social media just amplifies what are basic underlying problems. And a lot of that is to do with the rapidly changing world and the uncertainty of that. And I think that that's what's really causing a lot of the problems. And in an effort to try and control it, we as the parents are imposing a whole lot of structures and regulations and rules and administrations in our education systems. And we're taking away the freedom. We're taking away the opportunity to fail sometimes. And so people come, you know, they become frightened about not achieving the goals. And this sets up the anxiety. So unfortunately, we as the parents are largely responsible.
Oh God, the one thing that we never want to hear, right? I mean, there's always going to be a child somewhere reliving their awful parents on a psychiatrist's couch in their mid-30s, right? And it's always blame the parents. But I take your point, obviously, because we do have a lot to be blamed for. So, but what impact do you think that our digital culture is actually having on this level of anxiety that people are enduring?
Well, I think the main problem, as I said, is that we tend to be very egocentric, which means that we just see everything from our own perspective. And you look at the way technology is designed to engage people, it really does prey on our insecurities. And so selfies and self-promotion and feeling, you know, you need to have lots of friends and requiring validation and presenting unrealistic views of the world that people can't measure up to is always going to undermine anyone, irrespective of how confident they feel. So I think the technology just presents a very unrealistic world.
I mean, this is an aside question, really, but the amount of selfies that somebody puts out actually sends a signal to me that they are actually more insecure. Do you think that's a fair assessment, or is that just COD psychology?
No, that's true. There was a really fascinating study published last year showing that when you take people and get them to go either walking around a neighborhood, an urban environment, or going out into nature, and ask to take selfies, The size of the selfie shrinks when they're outside in nature. So in a sense, when you start to get in balance with the environment around you, you seem to be less self-focused. And people who take selfies generally don't enjoy experiences as much as those who are just taking photographs of the event, which is one of the reasons that artists hate to see people with their phones in concerts. And I ban them in my lectures. No one's allowed a smartphone in my lecture because I want their attention on me, not on themselves.
Oh, brilliant. Completely agree with you. We're going to go to some... No, I completely agree with you. I have a lot of problems with selfies. I mean, even as a journalist, I probably should do more than I do, but for exactly all those reasons, because I like to be present in the moment, even as a journalist. We're going to go to some news headlines, but we will be right back and find out more about the secret of happiness.
Big news, 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 news.
A story which contains more than first meets the ear.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan with your TNT headlines. Australia's Prime Minister's lashed out at ex-boss Elon Musk as the billionaire goes into battle to protect free speech.
I just find it extraordinary that this bloke thinks he's above the law.
The UK will start detaining migrants within days after plans to send them to Africa was approved by Parliament.
No ifs, no buts. These flights are going to Rwanda.
And 10 people have been killed in a horror mid-air collision involving two military helicopters in Malaysia.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
Bruce, we seem to be surrounded by bad news in our world. We just heard in the news break about 10 people being killed in a plane crash. How do we find happiness when we're constantly being bombarded with so much awful stuff happening to our fellow man and woman?
Well, look, you know, happiness is really how you respond to life, and life will always be problematic. There's always going to be things to get upset about. It's how you react to it and process it over time. You see, we're designed to pay attention to negative information. Our brains evolved to seek out anything which could be potentially threatening, which is why the news invariably is geared towards threats. They tried news channels before, which always had the happy items, and they generally weren't that interesting to the audiences because our brains are always turning us towards the more negative things. So that, again, is one of the problems of self-care. If you just rely on yourself all the time, then you're unfortunately going to be paying attention to the wrong information because your brain does it for you.
I mean, many people see happiness as a goal, right? This is what I have to achieve. This is what I have to pursue. But is it a sort of side result of pursuing a goal? I mean, that's how it feels to me. I feel happy because I do a job that doesn't always feel like I'm doing a job, if you understand what I mean, because this is what I enjoy doing. And I think that's a very privileged position. But what is happiness? Is it a goal to be reached, or is it just is it accompanying us as we go about our business?
Well, you know, this is a really interesting question you raised because I think you must have heard about the dopamine hit. I'm sure everyone talks about it, as if that suddenly when you're happy, you're dopamine. Actually, that's a myth. I'd like to say it now on public radio. It's a myth. Dopamine is the wanting molecule. It's the one that makes you pursue the things. It's the one that drives the goals. That's what makes you repeat the actions. That's what the neuroscience tells us about dopamine. So in a sense, our emotions are driven towards goals. All emotions are drives, whether they're positive emotions or negative emotions. They make you change your behavior. The word emotion has the same origin as motivation. It means to move. So we are driven towards goals and we're driven away from potential threats. So all our behavior is modified by these molecules in our brain, which are making us act in certain ways. The happiness that we experience is the pursuit of those goals and the acquisition, but that soon dissipates because you cannot be permanently happy. You would be sort of deliriously manic if you were always happy. In many ways, you have to experience unhappiness in order to pursue the next goal of being happier. So that's what happiness is. It fluctuates, it goes up and down.
That is absolutely right, because it's a fantastic motivator, isn't it? To make us say, I don't want to remain in this place. I want to be able to move on. You're absolutely right there. So, well, that sort of brings me to, how do we combat anxiety? How do we become just healthier on a day-to-day level?
Okay, so that's why you have to buy my book. There are 7 lessons.
Right.
And I I explain them all. The first lesson is called Alter Your Ego. And that just points out the fact that we're changing all the time. We don't think we change over life, but we will change in response to life events. And that's a good thing. That means that we can overcome things. The second lesson is avoid isolation. I point out that some of the greatest joys in life come from our interactions with others, and some of the greatest fears are the threats of loneliness and rejection. So avoid isolation. Number three is reject negative comparisons. Look at the news and then realize actually it's just too, you know, it's biased towards you. Number four is become more optimistic and explain how. Number five is control your attention, because if you're not controlling your attention, you'll be overtaken with negative thoughts. Number six is connect with others, go out and make those connections. And number seven is get out of your own head. Okay. Stop living inside your head and try and live in the heads of other people.
I think the last one is one of my favorites. Of course, Alter Your Ego is a very good one just for general life living, but get out of your own head. It's so hard to do, Bruce. How do you do it?
Well, you know, that's the nature of consciousness. We live in the present moment. We experience everything from the first person. But what you can do is you can start to appreciate the world around you. Find moments of awe. Look into the open air at night. Look at something, look at a tree, imagine who planted it, or a building, who built it. Just try and connect with humanity and see where we are relative to everything in the universe.
Yeah, it's very difficult, isn't it? Sometimes, as I say, people feel that happiness is this elusive quality that is not available to them. They look at their history, they look at the history of their family, they say, this is my lot. So already they're not in an optimistic mind state. So they've already got a challenge right there, right?
Well, there is a genetic component to it, but it's no more than intelligence. When they do the behavioral genetics and look at twins and they work out how much is it to do with the biology, happiness is the same as intelligence. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try educating or reading books or trying to change our world. In the same way, we shouldn't try to stop being happier.
And here's the thing that I think is important about your book is it actually is rooted in science. A lot of these kind of happy clappy books are a bit like chocolate, aren't they? They kind of just melt very instantly. They don't seem to materialize into anything. They sort of, you know, they make it sound so easy to change your mindset when it's really not always. You need the tools for that. So that scientific approach that you've brought to it, I mean, it's brought great reviews with it as well. A wonderful guide to what actually makes people happier, full of wisdom, backed by a wealth of scientific evidence. And that is really key. So scientifically, can we all be happy, even given our circumstances?
Yes, we can, but it requires constant effort. It's not something you can just do. It's not a one-off. It's like physical fitness. You don't go to the gym, lift up a heavy weight and say, I'm now fit. You got to keep at it. It's a constant process, a constant challenge. But with time and effort, it becomes easier. And, you know, I'd call this not a self-help book, but a self-destruct book, because I think it's this focus on the self, which is the problem, okay? We got to stop thinking the world's got to change in order to make me happy. It's not my identity. It's not my politics. I have to work with other people and I have to work with them in a way which is conducive to everyone. And that's what I'm saying.
We have become so egocentric, haven't we? And I think it's interesting that Alter Your Ego is at number one. How do you practically go about altering one's ego?
Well, that's where I think journaling really helps. And I think if you collect the evidence of your journals collected over time, you will realize that you are a different person. I look at my journals from 30 years ago and I think, my goodness, I don't recognize myself sometimes. But everyone does that. Everyone thinks they're never changing. But when we look back, we review the evidence, we realize that we can change. And I think that's an important part of recognizing your ego does change in relation to your circumstances and the people you interact with. And that also means that you shouldn't take full responsibility for everything. You should understand that you are responsible for some things, but some things are out of your control. And when you understand the interaction of your personality with the circumstances, I think that gives you a sense of comfort rather than just assuming that it's all you and it's never going to change.
Our viewers are writing in thick and fast here. Jason says, which is great because we love that. That makes me happy. Jason says, no news, no television, no politics, no Hollywood, no junk food, no ethanol. Be in control of your own life. Oh, use cannabis in all forms, pro-cannabis, clearly. What would you have to say about the usage of mind-altering drugs?
Well, I talk about them in the last chapter when I said get out of your own head, because that's what people use drugs to do very often. But, you know, sometimes that so-called self-medication can be counterproductive. It's not for everyone. I am a libertarian, but I do recognize that there's a lot of dangers to be associated with drug taking, especially those people who have vulnerability. So I wouldn't recommend it for everyone. There's a resurgent interest in psychedelics for the treatment of chronic depression, and it seems to be very encouraging. But these days, these are early days, and I'm not advocating anyone does anything illegal. But I do think you can alter your mind and alter your states of consciousness without necessarily taking toxins. You can do things like ceremonies, you can get involved in a choir, you can do things in nature, and that has much the same effect of turning down this network in the brain we call the default mode network. I talk about it in the book. It's this self-rumination network which fires up when you're not focused on a task, when you're kind of in your mind or inside your head, your default mode network goes into overdrive, and this is when you become self-critical, you start worrying, and that's when you become unhappy. Now, psychedelics alter the default mode network. But you can alter the default mode network by joining a choir, joining a group, doing things with other people in unison, finding synchrony. Those are the things which will change you the way you think.
You just used the key word there, which I often hear. I am somebody who studied psychology and I love the subject, but rumination, that is something that gets in the way of people's happiness a lot. Penelope says, sometimes you have to let go of the picture you thought your life would be and learn to find joy in the life you're actually living. And I think that's a really wise comment there. What are your thoughts about that?
No, absolutely spot on. I think we're our own worst critics for good reason. We're trying to improve ourselves. Excuse me. But I think we have to understand that sometimes we are, well, not sometimes, we distort a law of reality, and that's not good for our mental well-being.
I'm getting more questions. So many questions for you. People just want to be happy. That is the reality. Is there a connection between happiness and where you live in the world? Do warmer climates impact our happiness?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I also cover in the book this phenomenon that you find in the Nordic countries, that they are the happiest countries in the world. Every year they run a World Happiness League table, and they measure people's ratings of happiness on a 10-point scale. And at top of the scale is generally the countries like Norway and Denmark and places like Sweden and so on, the Nordic countries. And people go, why is that? Because they're dark a lot of the year. You know, they don't have a lot of sunshine. The reason is, it's because they trust each other. They have much more social trust. They have much more social support. And they don't feel in direct competition in the same way that we do in more individualistic societies like the West. Sunshine is an important factor as well, because there's a well-recognized
100%.
Phenomenon. Yeah.
And it's also the vitamin D, for example, you know, all of that, isn't it? I always feel better when the sun is out. I love that moment, you know, that sort of first day in spring when you're able to sit out in the garden and have a cup of tea in the morning. And I just feel so happy, like my sense of well-being goes up in that moment. Soul Sound says he must give great lectures, makes you want to go back to university. Indeed, it does. Thank you so much for I feel happy having talked to you. I feel happier. And thank you so much. This has been Professor Bruce Hood, and of course with his book The Science of Happiness. We will be right back. Thank you so much, Professor. Brilliant.
Thank you very much.
When the world's endangered animals need help most, when their lives are at greatest risk, when they would otherwise be lost, the International Fund for Animal Welfare is there, taking action to rescue the animals we love, to protect them and their threatened natural habitats. But the danger to animals the world over is growing, and the need for your help has never been more urgent. On land, you'll help stop poachers from threatening and killing elephants and big cats for the illegal wildlife trade. In the oceans, you'll help rescue dolphins, whales, and seals from deadly hazards. And you'll help rescue, rehabilitate, and release vulnerable animals when disasters strike. Here at home and around the world, we can't do this work without you. See how you can help animals and people thrive together at joinifall.org.
She used to dance and dream of a better life, a brighter future. Today, thanks to Children International and friends like you, she dances for the world. Together, we give children in poverty a chance to set their sights high and achieve their dreams. Learn more about Children International and join us in our life-changing work at children.org today.
Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk, TNT.
Now, the resignation of MP Mark Menzies this weekend is just another story in a long line of shamed politicians mired in sleaze, whether it's sending explicit pictures on phones partying when the rest of the country is in lockdown or the illegal use of party funds. Why are politicians so reckless? As a profession, are they psychologically predisposed to this sort of behaviour? Well, to help me find out, I am delighted to be joined by Dr. Peter Spencer, retired chartered health psychologist who has been on with us before. Good morning to you, Peter.
Morning, Sonia. Nice to be here.
Lovely to have you with us. Why are politicians so prone to this sort of behaviour, Peter?
Well, politicians are, but they're not unique. There's two sets of reasons, really, individual ones and social ones. People have focused and used the word psychopath, but that's incorrect. Psychopaths really fight against the system. They're tough characters. The kind of people we're really talking about are really quite compliant, quite conformist. The reason they've probably been selected as MPs, because they toe the line. They vote for anything they're asked to. So the picture of it is somebody who's quite compliant, quite conformist, toeing the line. Establishment figures, almost, as you used the word before, gatekeepers. I mean, to a different kind of profession, and you will probably know it from your experience in the music industry. If you look at Jimmy Savile, he was part of an establishment figure. He was very conformist. He was conformist with the establishment. So I think probably a better term, if you're looking for a personal description, is narcissistic personality or borderline personality disorder. Basically, these people, and they are largely men, I'm afraid to say, as a man, these people are vain and immature. I find the interesting thing about it all is that there seems to be a lot of evidence to show that these people actually want and actually like to get caught, which seems to be counterintuitive. But if you think of somebody who's a vain, immature young boy, they're kind of showing off, and it's almost kind of the thing to, it's almost a shame not to let people know what they're getting up to. It could also be that they're so confident and so self-obsessed, they're not aware of the effects that are happening. But they do outrageous things, and they up it all the time. If they're not caught, they up it, they up it, they up it, with Jimmy Savile or any of these MPs. So it ends up doing actually bizarre behaviours. And these people aren't unintelligent, you know, they just want to show, want to get caught. But yes, politicians are typical the way they're selected. But I'm certain from your experience in the music industry and other things that it's not unique to politicians.
No, it's definitely not unique. It's interesting that you talk about, obviously, NPD, narcissistic personality disorder, because I know a fair bit about narcissists. And one of the things that I know, of course, is they need fuel, don't they? They're sort of fairly empty as individuals themselves, whatever it is that's happened to them in childhood, but they need fuel from other people. So does that risk-taking supply them with the fuel that they need?
Absolutely. I think it's a two-way thing. That they kind of want attention. They need attention. And it tends to be a kind of a dance between the media and these people. I mean, you know, you don't have to be an investigative journalist to find these people out. You just go through the constituency and everybody knew. I live in Leeds. You didn't have to be an investigative journalist to find out about it. Everybody knew. So, yes, there is a fuel. There is a simple attention seeking if you're thinking about somebody who's very vain and very immature. And not being caught kind of takes that attention away from them. As I said, there are various theories about that. The attention seeking one is the obvious one. And the complete disregard of what the effect of other people around them. Some people even say this is going on for a long time. There might even be some sense of guilt that they actually want to get caught. And if you look at the politicians, if you look at Partygate, it was so obvious in plain sight. Everybody knew about it. I'm certain you knew about it. You weren't allowed to tell people, but everybody knew about it.
I told people everything I knew, Peter. You know me better than that. I can't help myself. I'm sure I'm on some sort of spectrum, but that's a whole other story for a whole other time. But no, I mean, the thing is, you're absolutely right. It is that risk taking, isn't it? But don't politicians want to be like fundamentally liked? Isn't that sort of part of what they're about? They have to be liked, don't they? Because they rely on public votes and the vote of confidence from other people.
Yes, they rely on public votes. But I suppose as a profession, they rely on the gratitude and sponsorship by people above. So the picture we have are people who are doing anything to please them. And I don't know if you agree with this, Sonia, it goes right the way to the so-called top. So even if you look at the Prime Minister, you really feel that he's complying with a particular script, like other people in his position. He's trying to comply, he's trying to get that support, he's trying to, yeah, he's trying to be loved, he's trying to but whoever they're trying to contact, less and less it seems to me that they're interested in feedback from the constituency, more about global issues, feedback from people above them, which again is a narcissistic thing. They don't really value feedback from people that they view as beneath them. What they do is value feedback about people above them. Again, I don't like coming back to it, but I'm from Leeds. Same with Jimmy Savile. Well, he wanted that feedback, he wanted that popularity, but he especially wanted it from people, I don't know if you agree with this, with the establishment.
Oh, 100%, no doubt about it. I mean, even though, you know, there are many stories about Jimmy Savile, and some of it I've covered in my documentary, Paedophiles in Parliament, there is absolutely no doubt whatsoever that he got a real buzz from name dropping and from being associated with members of the British establishment. No doubt about that at all. One of the things that you said, Peter, interesting, you said it is majority men in politics who behave like this. Is this a midlife crisis issue we're dealing with?
I don't know about a midlife crisis. If you look at these people, they've probably been like that all the way from small children.
Right.
They just haven't really matured. It's just that I suppose when they reach that part in their career, they've got more option. They've got funding to actually fund their particular kinds of behaviours or funding behaviours. So I don't know about midlife crisis. It could be that they're searching for something else. As you say, they're searching for more attention. They might need something else to feed it, but they've also got the resources to actually do that. Up to this point, they may have been going through the system, being counsellors, saying yes, yes to all the right people. And suddenly they look round and they've got some power. Probably for the first time in their life.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the most odious people I've ever met are actually politicians, no doubt about it. So if you were working with somebody with a checkered past who had been routinely accused of being all manner of things, from sort of, you know, narcissist to ego driven, somebody, say, for example, like Boris Johnson, where would you begin working with somebody like a Boris?
Well, that's very difficult. First of all, people like Boris would never come for help because they don't think they need help. Everybody else is wrong. They're correct. They see things the right way. Why can't the world go with them? So first of all, they haven't got the empathy. They haven't got the self-reflection to be aware that there is a problem. So technically, nobody ever turns up to a therapy room saying, I've got a narcissistic personality. Can you help me, please? It has to be done from outside. I would guess, and, you know, the media perhaps, the media feeds it. The media could modify it. The media easily, as you know, could modify it. They have the power. They have the power, as you said, to feed it. But they've also got the power to modify it as well, if they wish to. But as you know, it was just feeding, wasn't it? With the exception of people like yourselves.
Absolutely. And I do agree with you about the issue of like a midlife crisis, for example. That feels like that's an expression that belongs to yesterday, because we know so much more now about how people are and how people develop, right? But just talking about that, so away from Boris, let's have a look at women, for example. Would you, I mean, let's, what about someone like Liz Truss? Jim Ferguson was on last week, one of our commentators. He said one of the things that he can't stand about Liz Truss is she takes too many selfies. What does that tell you about a person when they take too many selfies, Peter?
I think that says it is. I think that's a form of self-perception. It is that as well. I don't want to stray into the physical realm. That's not my particular understanding. But the kind of things that Liz Truss did, when you think about it, and the kind of flack that she got, okay, yeah, taking selfies is a bit narcissistic, but, you know, taking selfies and things like that, compared to the things that other politicians did, which actually hurt other people, corrupted other people, controlled them. So I think as well, there might be a gender thing. I think she got a lot of this because she was a woman, and people almost expect higher standards from women. So in that sense, that's a relatively minor part to the kind of pyramid right at the top that people have, controlling people, managing people, destroying other people's lives.
I agree with you.
I think men essentially, I hate to say it's being a man, I think men essentially are more dangerous.
In all of those respects, are you talking about that?
And without trying to scare anybody, I do think it goes all the way to the top. It doesn't change. People just say, I'm at the top now. They try to please other people. They try to need more support. And these people have got the finger on a button. And if you want to think that these are vain and immature people.
Yeah, it is really scary.
They don't feel they're getting the attention. It's almost the ultimate attention mechanism, isn't it?
It really is. Let me throw something else into the mix, a bit controversial perhaps. Is it possible that this unpleasant character trait of theirs, where they are sort of prone to this behaviour and they can be risky and all of that, is that actually what makes them desire the top spot in the first place?
I'm certain it is. I'm certain that is the motivation. I sound very cynical these days, very cynical about politicians. I don't think any kind of, the number of people have written to their MPs, and the MPs just don't listen to them. They don't reply, or just a curt reply. I think it is about power, and I think it is to reach that point. I think it is to, again, don't like harping back a bit, but it's a local example with kind of Jimmy Savile. A lot of things that he did and the kind of power that he did, he was for. An ulterior motive to actually do that. I'm certain you're right. I don't think that's controversial.
And also, I think it's interesting that you say some of these people do want to be caught. So is this, so it's a cry for help at some points?
Well, as I say, it's a very well-defined phenomenon, and people have put various theories forward for that. One of them is a kind of guilt thing, that they want to be caught and almost punished, and that might be it. Another is that it's just another way of becoming more important about being fed more with this kind of attention. And part of it might be that they haven't got the emotional intelligence. I really don't know. I think it could be with some people. But one thing, it is a fairly recognised phenomenon, these people. I mean, Jimmy Savile tried his best to get caught, didn't he?
He was so open. When they say in plain sight, they're absolutely right. One of the comments he said was, if the local police want to take him down, they're going to have to take themselves down as well. So he was absolutely blatant. And that is narcissism, isn't it? Let me read you some of the comments, Peter. Max says, one of the tricks of narcissists is to sabotage everyone else, trigger them emotionally, and then trip them up. I know that for fact. And they also use the proverbial mallet to crack a walnut if required. So it's quite extreme behaviour, isn't it, that we're witnessing here? This is not everyday behaviour. We don't all behave like these MPs, Peter.
And of course, something that we've seen is gaslighting. It's another. I mean, the actual comments from the viewers are actually spot on. I would add gaslighting to that. Another way to perhaps, you know, to actually control people, to actually change people around, actually say, no, it's you, it can't be me, because I'm right, because I'm good. It's you. Gaslighting, again, is a classic. It's a classic.
Yes. Point. It really is. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Of course, none of this is new. We know about the John Perfumer affair as one perfect example from the 60s. Politicians have been notoriously problematic, haven't they, Peter? But we thank you greatly for addressing this with us. This is Dr. Peter Spencer, everybody. He's a retired chartered health psychologist. Thank you, Peter. Take good care of yourself. Have a good Tuesday. And that just about brings
us...
Thank you, Peter. Always love talking to you. Great. And coming up next, that brings us really to the end of our show this Tuesday. David Curtin will be joined by the bold explorer himself, Richard Vobes, and TNT's political editor, Basil Valentine, will also be joining him. Thank you so much for joining us today, for the whole team, for all your contributions. Keep mulling over the question of the day. I certainly will. What institutions do you still have faith in? I think the pub wins on the show today. Take good care of yourself. Stick around. TNT is the place to be. We'll see you tomorrow. Excellent.